Welcome to Santi for this evening's Dhamma talk and meditation. And this evening we'll start out with some guided metta meditation. We've been going a little bit, doing a little bit each week, taking a little bit step further through this practice. And each week so far I've been emphasizing practice of metta for oneself. And the importance of using this as a basis for one's practice. And so, having done that for a number of weeks, maybe it's time we'll start moving on to the second stage, which is metta for a loved person. So I want you to all think now, one loved person, and someone who's dear to you, that you can use for an object of metta. So you want to choose somebody who you feel simple and clear emotions for, not someone who you have complex love-hate relationship with, not someone who you feel unresolved issues with, but somebody who you feel like a very simple, childlike love for. If there isn't anyone like that, then just do the best you can. So, a good friend, close relative. Okay, so we'll start out as usual. Sit comfortably. Sit quietly, focusing attention on the feelings in the body, simply accepting those feelings, not resisting or trying to change them. Notice the emotions that you're bringing in. The mood that's carrying on over into the meditation. Know that fully. Accept it and let it go. until the mind feels clear. Neutral, open, leaving your focus of awareness inside your heart, and bring up the words of metta. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. Clearly, distinctly, carefully, you say the words consciously, bring up the meaning of those words, keep on reminding yourself what the words mean, evoking this pure, sustained wish for one's own true, deep happiness and well-being. continue notice that along with the words of metta, something else, something that's not the words, it's the feeling of metta, soft, joyful feeling of loving kindness. Notice that feeling, just hold that gently in your mind. Keeping your mind together with the feeling. Feeling comes strong and let it spill out, spread out through your whole body. Gradually soaking through each cell in the body from the top of the head through to the soles of the feet. Do you feel your whole body soaked through with loving kindness? Not going outside the body, keeping clearly defined and grounded inside the body. Feels full through your body, you can move to the second stage, keeping your mind just as it is, not going out of your body to that other person, simply substituting their name in the words of metta. So, for example, if you choose your father, then may my father be happy. May my father be happy. May my father be happy. Or whoever it is you choose. May that loved one be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. Keeping your awareness inside your body, just as before. To the first stage, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. Then letting go of the words of metta, letting go of the feeling of metta, allowing the mind to return to a neutral, empty, open space, clear. Still aware. Space. Take a few minutes to review over the course of the meditation, inquiring into cause and effect How did I approach the meditation? How did I use my mind? What kind of touch did I use with the meditation technique? What things was I confused about? What worked? How does my mind now compare with how it was at the beginning of the meditation? Finally, we can dedicate the merits of our practice. May all beings be happy, may all beings be safe. May all beings rejoice in the merit that we've made through our practice. May all beings finally realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu. Open your eyes and come out of meditation. So for this series of talks, we've been gradually looking at different aspects of the 37 Bodhipakkhiya Dhammas, the wings to awakening. And still on the first set, the first four of those, which is the four Satipatthanas. And last week we dealt with the Citta Anupassana, contemplation of mind. So this week I'd like to talk a little bit about the fourth of the four Satipatthanas, contemplation of Dhammas. So far we've had the body contemplation. If you remember, we talked about mindfulness of postures, mindfulness of death, mindfulness of breathing, mainly those three. And then we talked about mindfulness of feelings, Vedana Anupassana, and then contemplation of mind, Citta Anupassana. So the fourth one, contemplation of Dhammas. Now, when we come to this practice, this is one of those things which, in the end, is very simple, but unfortunately, in order to get to the end, we need to engage in just a little bit of clearing away. The reason for that is quite inherent in the very name of this practice, contemplation of Dhammas, because any of you who've been around Buddhism for a while would know that the word Dhamma is used in a frustratingly wide variety of senses. And so when we come to pin it down in any one particular context, we're not quite sure what it might mean in that particular context. Not only is the word itself a bit of a problem, but because it's such a central term in Buddhist philosophy, it becomes like a vehicle for everybody's agenda. So everyone who comes along in Buddhism with like a new perspective, then they try to read that perspective into it. And that is a process that continues up until the present day. And there was recently an article written by Rupert Gethin, an English scholar, and he was did the same thing, tried to argue about, make an argument on the basis of the use, way that dhammas is used here in Satipatthana. And then when I read that with my usual lack of restraint and patience, I then wrote off an article refuting his article and sent it to him. Said, here you go, here's why you're wrong. And he showed what a nice guy he is by writing back to me and saying, well, yeah, you've got a point. And the point was that he had taken as the basis of his article that particular description of this practice, which is based on the version of the Satipatthana Sutta found in the Pali Canon. And he hadn't taken account of the very many other versions of this particular practice. And so one ends up by making generalizations about the meaning of dhammas or the meaning of dhammanupassana based on really nothing more than the particular editorial decisions that were made by a group of redactors in a particular school at a certain time. And that's not good enough. So when we read Contemplation of Dhammas, when we read translations of the Satipatthana Sutta and all of those things, and they say that dhammas means mental objects and all of these kinds of things, we should look at it. It can't be true. How can this be true? How can you say that dhammas means mental objects? If we look in the way that it's described in the Satipatthana Sutta itself, for example, it talks about the six ayatana, the six senses, internal and external. And the external object of the mind base is dhammas in the sense of mental objects. Only that one. The rest of them aren't mental objects. How can dhammas mean mental objects in that sense? So we read time and time again these understandings of these things which are quite clearly incoherent. And that's important. Important. If it was just some obscure little sutta off in the corner of nowhere that no one ever read and no one paid any attention to, then it wouldn't matter. It would just be a matter for the scholars to argue about. But that's not the case. Satipatthana Sutta is very central to all modern schools of Buddhist meditation, whether Burmese, Thai, Sri Lankan, and even, say, the Vietnamese tradition with Thich Nhat Hanh, and so on and so forth. Very, very important, very influential, and we should be more careful about how we read it and what we read it to mean. You'll be relieved to know that I'm not going to bore you with all the details of everything, but what I will do is simply point to a very important sutta in the Sanyutta Nikaya, and also found in the Samyukta Agama, which I think gives us the key to unlock this. And that sutta says very simply, talks about the origin of each of the four Satipatthanas, which is quite an interesting idea. But briefly, the origin of the body is food, which is kind of sensible enough, isn't it? The food is what sustains the body. If you don't eat, then you die. Some people think that if they don't eat even in the afternoon, then they're going to die. Before the next morning. I haven't seen it happen yet. So then, second one, the origin of feelings is contact. And again, we can see that it's very easy, isn't it? You get contacted by something and then you experience some kind of feeling. The third one, a bit more obscure, but the origin of citta, the mind, is nama rupa, and name and form. We talked about this a little bit last week, but be good enough for now to think of name and form in this context as being like the objects of the mind, what the mind knows. And then the last one, dhammas, the origination of dhammas is manasikara, is attention. Now that's very interesting, isn't it? Because if we look at the list of dhammas that's found in the Satipatthana Sutta, we see a lot of them, we can't say, were originated by attention, manasikara. For example, it gives us the five khandhas, the body, the rupa khanda. How has that been originated by attention? Many other examples that are similar. So there's some kind of incongruity here. When the suttas talk about this, they say something's originated by attention. Invariably, what they're talking about is these two kinds of attention, yoniso manasikara and ayoniso manasikara. This is like wise or skillful attention and unwise, unskilled attention. So attention that goes back to the root of things, attention that goes back to the cause of things, attention that goes back to the source, inquiry, like an inquiry of mind that goes back to the source of things, that's not content to skim around on the surface but he's going to dig underneath and find out what lies behind things. I talked about that this afternoon after the meal, about the lovely story in the Visuddhimagga about the dogs and the lions, the difference between dogs and lions. And it says that other practices are like dogs, because when you, if you poke a dog with a stick, the dog will turn around and bite the stick, won't bite the person. Whereas Buddhism is like a lion, because if you poke a lion with a stick, it'll attack the person and not the stick. Now, I've never tested that out with lions, but I did test it out with dogs. And we had this one time when I was staying in Malaysia, and in the cave there next door, so this man used to keep this very, very large and ferocious and bad-charactered dog that used to bite people and all kinds of things. And it slipped off its chain and forced itself through the fence into our compound of our cave, and was causing a lot of problems there. And so I tried to get it out of the place so people could get out. There were children around and things. And I tried poking. I thought, I remembered this passage from the Visuddhimagga. I thought, oh, if I poke it with a stick, it'll bite the stick, it won't bite me. But I hope Buddha Gosa knew what he was talking about. So I grabbed a broom and shoved the dog, and sure enough, it was true. The dog bit the broom, didn't bite me. So that was a very useful piece of advice in there. So this is the task of this yonisomanasikara. So you can see in that sense the dog has a yonisomanasikara, because it bites the stick, whereas a lion, presumably, but I haven't tested this one out, the lion bites the person, not the stick. Not.
You're just waiting for it, aren't you? Yeah.
I'm not going to say it. Okay. So, yonisoma manasikara, inquiry into causes, investigation into causes. And that's the essence, that's the key to this dhammanupassana, contemplation of dhammas. In the Sanyutta and other key texts, when it talks about this, yonisoma manasikara, ayonisoma manasikara, most characteristically and frequently is mentioned in the Bodhanga Sanyutta, the Sanyutta on the seven and awakening factors. Now, these seven awakening factors are another one of the groups in the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas. Okay, so we'll talk about them in some detail a bit later. But for now, it's enough to know that in the Bodhanga Sanyutta, it very frequently pits the Bodhangas against the Nivaranas, the hindrances. So you've got, like, in the one corner you've got the five hindrances weighing 137 pounds, and in the other corner you've got the seven enlightenment factors weighing 142 pounds, and they are opposed to each other. And if you have ayonisoma manasikara, unwise attention, then you give rise to the hindrances. If you have wise attention, you give rise to the enlightenment factors. And there are very good reasons, I believe, to think that this is really what this dhammanupassana is about. It's about practicing wise or unwise attention regarding these five hindrances and seven enlightenment factors. What does that mean? Okay, that's a bit of jargon. I've thrown in a few doctrinal categories, okay, so we can, like, you know, throw in these doctrinal categories and then play with them. We can manipulate them and so on. But what does that actually mean in experience? Of course, the five hindrances are invariably those things which are obstructing samadhi, those things that have to be abandoned before one gets into jhana. It's the five hindrances. The seven enlightenment factors: mindfulness, investigation of dhammas, energy, rapture, tranquility, samadhi, and equanimity. Okay, these are the qualities of mind which very closely related to the practice of samadhi or jhana, and which are, the Buddha said, these things lead to enlightenment. That's why they're called the enlightenment factors. So we have the things that hinder and the things that help one from gaining a peaceful mind. Now, so far over the whole series of talks on Satipatthana, we've talked about these kinds of questions in many ways. I've talked about meditation and those things that are useful to meditation, those things that oppose meditation. And I've tried to show how, in the context of Satipatthana, we can see what is partly, on one hand, is partly a description of how to practice, and yet on the other hand, is like a it's almost not like telling you what to do. It's merely reflecting back to yourself what's actually happening in your mind already. And so you practice with the three kinds of feelings, pleasant, painful, or neutral. This is like reflecting back into your mind what is there already. And so on with each aspect of Satipatthana, it's remaining very grounded in what is real. So this is not kinds of meditations which are, you know, trying to construct some kind of world out there. You're not trying to, like, for example, build up an image, or, you know, like this kind of building complex pictures of deities and visualizations and things like that. This is not like Satipatthana meditation. Satipatthana meditation is, how do you reflect on that reality of your experience in a wise way that's going to lead me to peace and wisdom? So this is what you've been doing that whole time in Satipatthana. And we've seen that at each stage there are things which support the meditation and things which oppose it. And we've talked about that in many different ways. And for example, in Cittanupassana last week, we talked about the mind with lust, the mind without lust, the mind with hate, without hate, and so on. When we come to this Dhammanupassana, seems to be more or less the same kind of thing. Again, we're talking about the five hindrances and the mind without five hindrances. So, for example, the first of the five hindrances is sensual desire. Very similar to talking about the mind with lust, isn't it? It's the same kind of thing. So what's the difference? The difference is that Yoniso Manasikara, earlier in those previous practices, we were seeing these things, we were experiencing them, we were knowing them. But we weren't understanding them in such a deep way. We weren't understanding them in terms of cause and effect. And that is the key. That is the difference. Through practicing those first three Satipatthanas, you learn to establish your mind on an object of meditation. We learn to develop and understand those different kinds of feelings, and to develop the blissful, happy feelings of meditation. We learn to abandon unskillful states of mind, develop skillful states of mind until the mind is bright and clear. All of those things are within that practice. And yet we haven't seen deeper than that. We don't know why that is the case. What is the cause? What is the reason? And this is the difference that is emphasized at each stage of this meditation on Dhammanupassana. One sees sensual desire. And it's there, you know it's there. When it's not there, you know it's not there. Then you know how unarisen sensual desire comes to arise. You know how arisen sensual desire comes to be abandoned. And you know how there comes to be no more sensual desire arising in the future. This investigation into cause and effect, you know why, you understand why. So it's not just it's not by a chance that you get into samadhi or not get into samadhi. It's not by chance that your mind is peaceful or not peaceful. It's not just by following some technique that you can do meditation. It's not just because you're doing what the teachers told you to do. It's because you understand how the mind works. And when you understand how the mind works, you can make it work every time, and it's not going to be hit and miss anymore. So somebody who has this Dhammanupassana very strongly and very deeply will be able to meditate quickly, efficiently, and reliably, be able to learn how to make their mind peaceful because they understand how the mind works. So because of this understanding, we are seeing how these different aspects of meditation that we call Samatha and Vipassana, how they relate to each other. The Samatha is making the mind peaceful. Vipassana is understanding the nature of cause and effect. So we're seeing that Vipassana, we're seeing that nature of cause and effect emerge from the practice of meditation. The practice of samadhi, understanding that process, understanding when I use my mind in this way, my mind becomes scattered. When I use my mind in that way, my mind becomes slothful. You don't just see that, you understand it. When you understand it, you can predict it. And you can't control those mind states. You can't say to yourself, I'm going to make my mind bright, and then just do that. You can't say to yourself, I'm going to make my mind peaceful, and just do that. But what you can say is, I'm going to use my mind in this way. I'm going to pay attention in this way. And when I pay attention in that way, these certain qualities won't arise, and these other qualities will arise. And this is the understanding which is at the heart of Dhammanupassana. So the Buddha talked in terms of quite specific causes for these things. Each one of these five hindrances has its own specific nutriment, its food. So when you give that hindrance its food, then it will be healthy and strong. It will come like a stray dog at your back door, slavering and wanting some more food every day. And when you open up the back door to throw out the bone, it'll probably bite your hand off as well. Because the more food you give it, then the more it wants. So the food for this first one, sensual desire, the food is the subha nimitta. Su meaning good, bha meaning appearance. Subha, good appearance, beautiful. Subha nimitta. In this context, a nimitta doesn't mean what we usually think of it as, like a bright light you see in meditation, okay? And I have to keep on saying this because it's not very widely realized. Nimitta, in that sense, is a much later usage. In the suttas, meditation, nimitta usually means an aspect of experience, some kind of aspect of what's happening in your mind, an aspect of the meditation, an aspect of what you're experiencing, which will promote the growth of similar qualities, okay, or similar or related qualities, okay. So I'll give a simple example. If your mind is, if you pay attention to, if you look at something peaceful, then that tends to make your mind peaceful. So in that sense, that thing, a peaceful thing you look at, is the nimitta that's causing those qualities of peace to arise in your mind. If I look at a lunid cartoon and it makes me laugh, then that lunid cartoon is the nimitta which is making happiness in my mind. Okay? So it's that thing which is promoting the growth of certain particular qualities. So the subha nimitta is that aspect of things, that dimension of things, which is beautiful, attractive, good-looking, seductive. So obviously not meaning simply sights, but sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch. And also thoughts, memories of those sight, sound, smell, taste, and touches. All of these things, when we concentrate on the attractive side of those things, and this is the subha nimitta. Okay, so this is quite specific. It's a very precise definition of what's going to give rise to sensual desire. As well as being very bright, precise, it's also, of course, very broad, isn't it? It can encompass a huge variety of things. Obviously, sexual desire is a very strong one. And in the mind, this is one of the most powerful of all our drives. Possibly not the most powerful. Often we think it's the most powerful one. We don't kind of reflect on what's the purpose of this. Why is, we know that sexual desire is such a powerful force in the mind. Why is it like that? Why is it that if we see someone who we think is sexually attractive, that such a powerful image in the mind, so hard to take your eyes off, so hard to take your mind away from that person? Why is it that only, you can be in a room and maybe there's no one that turns you on. There's no one you find attractive. And then suddenly the right woman or the right man walks in and boom, you can hardly talk. You break out in a flush. You're nervous. You can't do anything. Why is it that people can have such a powerful effect on each other? Obviously, we can look at that in biological terms, that's at least part of the story. There's a need to perpetuate a species. But that, how true is that really? We want to perpetuate the species, but that's a fairly kind of abstract kind of idea. But if we understand what Darwin was getting at, he talked about like the survival of the fittest. It's actually not really the survival of the fittest, it's the survival of the continuous survival of what's going to last the longest. So through having intercourse, having children, then one gives rise to more of oneself in the future, and you pass on your genes in the future. And it's interesting that you hear, like, these days I've heard quite a few people, even Buddhists, who believe that somehow they're kind of reborn in their children through passing on their genes to their children. They kind of believe that their self is their genes, their DNA, which can be passed down. And that DNA has a continuity. And this is one of the insights that Richard Dawkins pointed out, that, you know, an organism can rise and pass away. Our lifetime is not very great. But the life cycle of our genes is very long. Genes outlast us by far. From a genes point of view, an organism isn't really much to speak of. From a genes point of view, an organism is just a kind of a means of perpetuating the genes further. That gene has existed for millions and millions of years, or at least for many thousands of years. And the organisms are just like a passing parade from the point of view of that gene. So you can see this is kind of desire for continuity, that desire to kind of hold on to what is, which of course is like the flip side of the fear of death, the fear of discontinuity. So this is a very important part of that, sexual desire is all about. Of course, it's not the whole thing. There's many other aspects to it as well. The desire simply for physical pleasure, the desire for intimacy. A lot of it, I think, is, if we look deep into our minds, you can see there's this feeling of lack, or this feeling of incompleteness. That's often expressed mythologically. They talk about, like, in the beginning there was, in the Upanishads, it talks about in the beginning there was like kind of one beast, and it was just like, you know, created whole, and then later on it was split into two, and those two became man and woman. And so the man and woman always have that desire to reunite, become one again, because there's a feeling like somehow if they're separated, that they're incomplete, that men and women literally are made for each other. And so I think that there's a very important part of that whole sexual desire is this, like, feeling of wanting, like, a complete union with another person, wanting that person to complete what I feel like I'm lacking, what I'm incomplete in. And obviously, to a certain extent, it works. And for many people, that is a very meaningful and very deeply moving time of intimacy when people are having sex. And it can be done in a way, if people have real or a genuine sense of care and concern for each other, then it can, in a sense, kind of start to transcend the boundaries of your own self, who you think you are. And when you're kind of aglow in the wash of hormones or whatever that's bathing your whole brain at the time, then you really feel like there's this kind of total sense of acceptance with that person, a sense of trust. And you can expose yourself in a very totally personal, intimate way with them, and then this complete trust, complete giving with that person. And that can be very beautiful. But of course, like anything else, and it has its limits. It just lasts for a while. And then what happens? Time goes on. Those feelings fade away, like all feelings fade away. That feeling of unity and oneness disappears, like all feelings will disappear. You get up in the morning, put your clothes on, go into the bathroom, brush your teeth, you look in the mirror, and you are just as ugly as you were the night before. In fact, probably worse. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing you can do about it. So we can be on this kind of search, this constant search, if you like, believe that there's kind of one true love for us, one true partner that's going to solve all our problems. We just have to find them. And when we can leave them, then there's the kind of like the movie fades and kind of Vaseline smeared violins. And that's going to be it forever. And I'm sure it must have been true for someone sometime. haven't found anyone yet, but I'm sure somebody sometime must have been like that. But the reality is that our lives change. You can have those moments of wonderful intimacy, union, communication with somebody, and then it can go on. The next day you can feel completely alienated from them. They can do something that'll just really jack you off. You can feel like the complete stranger sitting next to you right the next day. Or even worse, you just feel like you just don't want to be anywhere near them. Like, get away from me. And so the more you get into that, then the more you invest into it, and then the more you are hurt when it falls apart. And these things don't fall apart for like any kind of particular reason. They just fall apart because it's the nature of things to fall apart. Again, you know, don't look on the skin of experience. Don't worry about that. You ask why do these people can't get on or anything like that. The reason why relationships break up is because conditions are impermanent and things are always changing. And it's the nature of those things to be like that. Can't be any other way. So we all know that when we have those kinds of feelings, like when we feel we're in love with someone, then all you see is that Subha Nimitta. At that time, that loved one for you is just so beautiful. Everything they do is just wonderful. Everything they say is just amazing. And you kind of fill with this glow of just seeing this Subha Nimitta exclusively, and you can't see anything else. But this is just impermanent. It's just like a way of seeing things. It's not that it's untrue. Of course it's true. Of course it's real. But it's only like one side of reality. It's only one aspect of it. It would be great if we could go through our lives only seeing that, only seeing the Subha Nimitta, and our lives would be very, very blissful. Maybe it's what life's like in the heaven realms. You can go up there and just see the beautiful side of everything. But our world here, it's not like that. Our world has Subha, the Asubha, the beautiful and the repulsive. So this is why we have to understand this cause and effect. Understand that when you focus on that Subha Nimitta, that attractive, appealing aspect of things, then that will give rise to more and more desire for that. That will provoke desire for those things. You can't stop wanting those things. You can't choose that. What you can choose is where you'll put your attention. And so, if you're in a case, in a situation where you do feel desire, and you want to overcome that, some kind of attachment that's causing you suffering, then use your wisdom. Focus on the other side. Acknowledge that other side. Don't turn that other side into an ultimate reality. That's not ultimately true either. One side is not true, the other side is not true. Or one side is just as true as the other side. But really, what's true is the relationship between these things. What's true is this relationship of cause and effect. And that is the Dhamma. That is the contemplation of Dhammas. Cause and effect. Dhamma is the principle. Dhamma is that law of nature. That this is how things work. Not how they are, okay? Not seeing how things are. You're seeing how things become. So the second of these five hindrances is ill will. Vyapada, and we talked a little bit about that this afternoon. And the origin of this vyapada is patigha nimitta, the nimitta, the aspect of resistance or reaction, right? Almost quite literally, pati means against, and gha in this context means something like to hit, hitting against something. So that striking of things, impact of things. This is what gives rise to anger or ill will. So we all know what that means, don't we? We've all been with people and people get on our nerves. Yeah? This is what it means. We all see things that we don't like. We smell things. And sometimes you can smell things that just are so horrible you can't hardly endure it. This is that patigha nimitta. Again, the same way, we have to learn what kind of food we're giving to the mind that's going to give some kind of results. If we keep on focusing on that patigha nimitta, if we train our mind to look at that repulsive or resistive aspect of things, if we allow our mind, indulge our mind in that negativity of kind of wearing the pathways in our mind between the mind, the awareness, and the door of aversion. We keep on walking backwards and forwards down that pathway, making the paths broad and smooth and easy to walk on, and then that aversion will grow and increase in our mind. If we don't do that, if we cut through that, if we know we're not going to walk down that broad and easy path, we're going to find another way. It doesn't lead to that door. Find another way that leads to somewhere else. Turn the mind away from that which is causing us anger. Consciously, deliberately paying attention to, not to the resistive aspect of things, but to the positive aspect of things. We can see that these two, desire and aversion, are like a pair. And of course, you know, we're all sensible people, and we realize that the world does have these kinds of dichotomies. It revolves around these things, day and night, up and down, left and right. We can't have one without the other. Okay? We can't eliminate one without eliminating the other. We have to work on both, and we have to develop strategies and approaches in our mind that will lead us to abandoning both of these things. So to abandon the sensual desire given rise by the subhanimitta, the attractive aspect of things, we focus on the unattractive aspect of things. So to get rid of the ill will, which means focusing on, which arises from seeing the resistive aspect of things, then we focus on the positive side of things. Practically speaking, in meditation, the most normal or straightforward way of doing this is to overcome sensual desire by doing a subha meditation, contemplation of the parts of the body, or corpse contemplation, and overcome ill will by doing metta, seeing the positive aspect of people, developing positive, healthy emotions. So it's greed, hatred, and with greed, hatred, the next three of the five hindrances, all of them, in one way or another, are on the side of delusion, different aspects of delusion. So the first one is a very obvious sign of delusion, is sloth and torpor, falling asleep. Oh, how beautiful it is. Just that bliss of nothingness. No worries, no responsibilities. You can do anything in your dreams and get away with it. Almost. Sometimes your id might be there wielding a guilty rod over you, guilty dunda. Yeah, I said it. I couldn't stop myself. Couldn't get through a whole talk without saying the word dunda. You can just lie there, it's like comfy on your bed. Even if you sleep on just like a thin mattress like we do in the monastery, still it's pretty comfy. Relatively speaking, you can just lie there and relax all the limbs. Oh, it's just so beautiful, and then you just drift away. Nothing to worry about. Oh, it's like drowning in this kind of morphine. Yeah, it's just so lovely. Why don't we just do it all the time? Come on, let's just try to do it constantly. Anyone can do that? Can you just keep sleeping all the time? What if you had the most comfy bed in the whole world? Feathered down bed. You could just lie in that an acre. An whole acre of bed. That's what we used to do a song in my band. An acre of pillows was one of the lines. You've got an acre of pillows. And you just got to lie there. Like 100 meters deep of feather down. And you just flop and nothing to do. No responsibilities. No letters to write. No chores to do. Nothing. Never get hungry. Never go to the toilet. Just have to just flop around in his bed. Wouldn't that be wonderful? You can just do that the rest of your life. There's a lady in America who actually wanted to do that. She had this kind of, she was an old spinster. Her whole life she'd never been in a relationship, and she had developed this kind of dreamer family where she would go to sleep and dream, and she had this very handsome young husband and all these beautiful children, and his whole life, which he had in her dreams, which she didn't have in her real life. And she went to a doctor, and she wanted the doctor to give her some drugs so she could sleep all the time and just dream about her dream family. And her doctor said no. And this being America, she said, right. She took him to court, and she sued him to be allowed to go to sleep all the time, constantly. I don't know why she bothered. She just walked out of any corner and buy it off some guy, shady guy with sunglasses on the corner. Anyway. And that's it, isn't it? It's actually, I've read that it's actually impossible to sleep constantly for more than a certain amount of time. You can kind of sleep for a number of hours, but since you sleep, I think, 18 hours or something like that, then it's impossible for people to sleep longer than that. It's a great story, one of my favourite stories by Bourget, called The Circular Ruins. We have a copy out there, it's highly recommended. And it's about a fellow who wanted to practice by sleeping constantly. And he like applied himself diligently to this practice. Day in, day out, day out. He managed to get it so he would just wake up for long enough to be able to grab a bite to eat and to have a bath, and then back he'd be diligently working on his sleep again. And he managed to sleep so hard he dreamed a man who came alive and who really existed. He went into that dream world. I won't tell you the ending of the story though. But it's a very good thing to contemplate when you go into that sleep. When you're actually in there, of course, the world of your dreams seems like it's real. The more further you get into that, the further it feels like it's real, even though obviously it's not. And the famous philosophical problem is, how do you actually make that clear distinction? I mean, we all know what the difference between being asleep is and being awake. We all know that. But actually, if you want to pin it down, how do you actually do that? What's the actual difference? It's quite hard. And so this is that world that we're living in sleep. The Buddha said, actually the Buddha recommended it for some people. Like people who are like, if you're, Ivan Milat or something like that, you're going to go out and murder people or burn down people's houses or go around raping women or something like that, then you're better off sleeping. But for the rest of us, the Buddha said that sleeping is barren. It's a waste of time. So obviously there are certain kind of physiological or psychological needs which are met through sleeping. But apart from that, then we waste a lot of time through sleeping. Even though it has this kind of an enjoyment, this enjoyment of absence. It's a very subtle kind of enjoyment. Yet it doesn't lead anywhere. It doesn't go beyond itself. We have to reflect like that, and we kind of reflect on it and try to give rise to energy in our mind. So this is like the nimitta that gives rise to sloth and torpor, is that nimitta of like laziness, that nimitta of not wanting to do something, not wanting to put forth effort, not wanting to be alive, not wanting to be awake. Look at that in your mind. You can see there's that like switch in your mind when you're meditating. You're meditating, especially late at night, you notice that the switch, suddenly the thought comes into your mind, oh, maybe I should have a lie down. You know? Just notice it, the kind of what that does. It's one of the reasons why it's very good to practice by staying up all night meditating. I don't think it's a great practice to do for your meditation as such. It's more kind of just like endurance. But you do learn about this trickiness of the mind, that it tells you that it needs some sleep, and actually if you keep going you just come through it and you stay awake. It's just very similar to feelings of hunger. I'm sure you will experience that, where you feel hungry, you've got to eat something, but you don't eat anything, and then after half an hour the feelings of hunger are gone, you've completely forgotten it. And feelings of sleepiness are just the same, they'll come and they go. So the next one is more or less like the opposite of sleepiness, and that's restlessness and remorse. Restlessness, all our minds all over the place. Because no one here has that problem, so it should be alright. One of my favourite comments on that, which really says it all, was that whereas this kind of getting one-pointedness of mind may have been possible for the ancient Indians with their very much slower pace of life, than these days our modern life and the rapid communications and the fast pace of life, then it's probably impossible to get that one-pointedness of mind. And that was said by Max Müller in the 1880s. This is like flurry in the mind, restlessness, wanting to be here, wanting to be there, not being content to be where you are. How do you know if you don't have restlessness in your mind? It's very easy. You don't have restlessness in your mind. Your mind is absolutely, totally, 100% content to stay in one place and not move one single jot. That's the test. You can have your mind in one place, absolutely still, certain, centered, without straining, without trying, simply content, utterly still, and just stay like that. Then you know there's no restlessness in my mind. But if you can't do that, then you know there is restlessness in your mind. The food for this, the nimitta for this, is diversity, seeing the manifoldness of the world, thinking about lots of different things, wanting lots of different kinds of experiences. These are the things that lead to restlessness in the mind, where you're always not here, it's always out there, it's always tomorrow, it's always the next thing, it's always somewhere else. This isn't good enough. My life, my experience, my mind, what's happening to me, my consciousness, this is not good enough. Whatever it is, it's not good enough. That is better. This is where restlessness comes from. So we have to develop this tremendous sense of contentment. And this hindrance has like two aspects. We say udaccha kukuccha. Udaccha is like this restlessness, so that's future orientated. It's running off to the future. Kukuccha means literally means what has been badly done. And it means like remorse for things in the past, things which you've done, which have been bad, been unethical, things that have hurt yourself or others, or things that you've omitted, things which, you know, if you might feel remorse because you should have meditated all day yesterday and you didn't, you slept all day or whatever it was. So this is like remorse, it's like ghosts from the past which come and haunt us. And be careful of these things. These things are very subtle. They will cause this cloudiness of the mind, this dullness, this lack of happiness, lack of joy in the mind. If you find a problem with having a lack of joy in your mind and your meditation, it may well be that the problem is here with this remorse. Maybe there's something you feel like you've done in the past or you feel like you haven't done in the past. And that's giving this this obscurity to the mind. The best way to overcome or to help this is simply through practice of sila, keeping your precepts very carefully, very spotlessly, always treating everybody with the utmost care and concern and kindness, and having like a regularity and discipline in your practice that will give you that kind of basis for not feeling remorse in the future. And the last one of these hindrances is the hindrance of doubt. I think there goes the modern paradigm of doubt. A modern great modern myth of doubt must be Chogyam Trungpa, who was driving along the road one night. He's one of the first generation of well-known Tibetan teachers in America. Driving along the road, nighttime, comes to the fork in the road, and he knows that if he follows that the right-hand fork goes to the meditation center. The left-hand fork goes to a really wild party. He drives down the middle and smashes into a tree. Now that is a classic. But you can't do anything. Actually, probably even going to the party is probably better than smashing into a tree. You've got to make some decision. You've got to be able to decide things in life. You've got to be able to say yes or no, this or that. And life is actually a sequence of choices. Don't be afraid to make choices. Okay? According to there were some psychological experiments done in the 1970s with rats on mazes and electric grids. I can't remember all the details of it, but the result of it seemed to be that for the rats, it was actually that the stress was caused in the rats, not so much by the physical pain of the crossing the grid, but there's like kind of electric grid and then food on the other side. And the grid was electrified sometimes and then sometimes it wasn't. So the rat had to sort of make the choice. Do I cross over to get the food with a certain percentage of chance of getting my feet electrocuted or something like that? They weren't killed or anything like that, but they were just zapped as they were walking across a bit. And so there's this like kind of tension of choice of do I risk it or do I not? And it found that actually that was where the stress was caused in the rats. You can actually induce a very high level of stress in the rats. You want to, but if you did want to, you could, through this kind of forcing them to make this choice. And so there's a lot of dukkha in that, because choice is always based on expectations of the future. And we never know what's in the future. You don't know what's going to happen. You can do all of the research you want. You can do a consider everything, all the factors, everything you want, make your choice, and then it'll turn out different. You never know. So all you can do is just do your best, spend enough time to work out what needs to be done, and then do it. And once you do it, then don't have any regrets. Don't keep looking over your shoulder. Don't keep wondering what might have been. Just do it. And it's imperfect. It's as imperfect as it is. So our life consists of this series of choices that we have to make. And that, of course, is totally determining all our experience, isn't it? You know, we've made so many choices. The choices that we've made happen to have led us here, to this group of people sitting in this room together, listening to Dhamma together. These are this whole unimaginable series of choices that we've made that's leading to this unrepeatable moment. So to overcome this sense of doubt, we need to use this kind of like inquiry or search into cause and effect, understanding how things work. So this is actually the essence of Dhammanupassana, of contemplation of Dhammas, is precisely this investigation into cause and effect, inquiry into good and bad Dhammas, and what leads to good Dhammas, what leads to away from bad Dhammas. And this, knowing this, is what will lead to abandoning of doubt. We will know what leads to what. Doubt is abandoned by seeing cause and effect. And this is why stream enterer completely abandons doubt, because they've seen cause and effect, they've seen dependent origination. They understand how the mind works. So keep on inquiring. Whenever you see problems in your mind, look at what's the cause for that. When you see if you're being greedy at the mealtime, inquire into that. Why is that? If you're getting upset and angry with other people in the community, inquire, what's the reason for that? If you find that you're lazy, just going back to your kuti and falling asleep all day, inquire, what's the reason for that? If you find that you're just always restless, if you can't settle down into your meditation, inquire, what's the reason for that? Understanding these things gradually wear away at your doubt and gradually give you that wisdom and that confidence to know how to practice, how to use your mind. I talked before about last week about Chittanupassana, about how about the nature of the mind, how the mind is not intrinsically pure or impure, but is intrinsically, its nature is to be conditioned. And so the Buddha used this series of very beautiful similes in this context with the five hindrances. It's like water, the mind is like water, and sensual desire is like the mind which is dyed, very bright colour, like bright blue or bright red. Anger is like the mind which is boiling. Boiling water is like the mind with anger in it. Sloth and torpor is like the mind which is overgrown with weeds. You know, like a very stagnant pool overgrown with moss and weeds. And restlessness is like a mind, like the water which is ruffled up by the wind. You know, a very strong breeze blowing over and stirring up the water. And doubt is like the mind which is very turbid and murky, and which is put into a dark place. You can't see through it. And you see, actually, water is like that. We look out in the world, we look into nature, you see water in all of these kinds of cases. You can see coloured water, you can see disturbed water, you can see boiling water, you can see all of these kinds of things actually are true, they actually exist in the world. And there also is water which is none of these things. Water which is clear, which is still, which is pure, and that is just as natural. That is simply what happens to the mind when all of those things are absent, when all of those conditions are not there. And so this is the simile the Buddha used. It's like a man with good eyes would look into a pond and would see the fish swimming around, would see the stones in the pond, would see the weeds growing in the pond, because the water is very clear. So eradicating these five hindrances, they're called the panyadubalikarana, those things that weaken wisdom. When they're gone from the mind has strong wisdom. It can see through the water and it'll see what is there. So that's my talk for this evening on Dhammanupassana and especially on the five hindrances. So I offer that to you for your reflection, and I'd like to invite anyone who has any comments or questions.
It sort of begs the question, but I notice that there really has to be a certain amount of stability in the mind to actually be able to pull yourself out of the hindrance, to know that you're stuck in it, or that the mind's actually there anyway, because otherwise it's just fogged and you don't know where you are, you know? It's just,
yeah, sure.
It's just in there.
Yeah.
So, unless there is this some sort of platform, or I don't know, some sort of minimum level of awareness. Just, you don't even know it in it.
Right. And that's why I think that the Dhammanupassana is like the last of the ones, last of the Satipatthanas, because when you do Dhammanupassana, you're relying on that basis of having a reasonable amount of awareness. Earlier in your practice, basically, you just have to go for it. Yeah? You just have to actually do the practice. Someone says, meditate like this, and you just have to sit down, follow the instructions and do that. And you don't necessarily really understand what you're doing. We understand on a certain level, but not really deeply. So you just got to go blindly and just try your best to do what you can. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And as you keep on going, you gradually figure it out and it begins to come together more. And it's the same like learning any kind of skill, you know? And if you want to learn to play the guitar, you know, when you first do it, you don't know what you're doing. Someone says, this is E major, and you put this finger here and this finger there and that finger there, and then you hit the strings in that way. You don't understand why that's a chord, or why that chord sounds like that in relation to other chords or anything like that. You just do what they tell you to do. And as you go on, you learn to understand things better.